Today on Movie Wallahs, we talk about Destroyer and if Beale Street could talk. It's time for Movie Wallahs. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Wallahs is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news and general banter. In theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. And we have a little bit of time today, I guess, for some general banter, because we've got two movies to talk about. And unfortunately, I think due to scheduling, not all of us have watched all of them.
Sorry, Yazdi.
Makes for a little bit of a shorter episode. Yazdi,
that's okay.
Yes. You and your day job
me
interfering
and my day
with this
prevented me
second
watching.
Life that we have reviewing movies.
Yes, but that's good. According to your suggestions, I may or may not.
Oh, that's true.
Jump.
You can save you some
it
time.
Save me some time, or not.
Or not. Yeah, I was going to say that's the problem with this time of year. Tends to be loaded with the heavier movies. So one thing I did want to kind of banter about a little bit was what I previewed in the last episode, which is this whole AMC MoviePass thing. So Rashmi and I missed out on the whole MoviePass, the heyday, I think, the time mm-hmm. when you could go see any movie anywhere as much as you liked. And I think
one a day.
Well, you know what I'm saying, but it was
for
kind
just
of like
$9.95,
yeah. $10 a month, and you could essentially have Netflix, but for in theatre movies. So that's kind of too bad, but I also recognised at the time that business model was not sustainable. So we've recently cancelled our movie pass because we found that every time I opened the app, they restricted you to a certain number of movies at a certain number of theatres, and it was never the ones you wanted to see. And in fact, the last couple of times I opened it, the theatres near us didn't even have any options for MoviePass. So it's just getting very frustrating. So I commend the guys at MoviePass for the disruption that they were trying to do. But, you know, it's too bad for, I think, everyone that we can't find a way to maybe do something like this, other than maybe what AMC is doing. But
yeah. So I was saying to Joe, I mean, the one good thing that MoviePass did do is that it disrupted the
monopoly.
Industry, in a sense, and you know, now AMC's come up with their own A-list, which is $20 a month, three movies a week, which is great value.
Without restrictions,
that's
including
important.
IMAX and 3D.
One major restriction is obviously you're limited to AMC theaters.
Sure.
So,
but they're the big multiplex.
Yeah, but I mean, I kind of like. I worry about the ArcLight and especially the landmarks of this world in such a place where if everyone's paying a subscription to a certain movie theater, how many subscriptions can you have, and what will that do to the smaller theaters? But nonetheless, I mean, I think these are interesting times, and we've seen home movies be disrupted. Sorry, Yeti. Go.
No, I was going to say, in its heydays. It's funny to talk about heydays in relation to MoviePass, but in its heydays, it was when it was good, it was really good. Because in its heydays, it was almost any theater, most of the theaters were participating, and every movie shown at that theater was participating.
Right.
And so you had like a pick of anything. And you know, because it was $10 a month, you can watch a movie a day. I landed up watching a lot of movies which I wouldn't have otherwise watched because I wouldn't have necessarily spent $15 or $20 on it. Because it's a risk. And now it's like, oh, I have nothing to lose. Let me just watch it. So, you know, it was great because it allowed you to kind of experiment more with movies. And I think it was you, Joe, who told us early on that I think the MoviePass people were hoping that enough people would sign up with them that the theaters would have no choice but to kind of build some kind of or develop some kind of deal with MoviePass moving forward. But alas, that never came to be. I don't know if they never reached the critical mass in terms of number of people signing up or if the theaters played, you know, hardball. But whatever it was, it kind of fell through. And part of me wishes that MoviePass had just kind of done a clean death. But what they've been doing is slowly kind of turning off things. And now even at the theaters that they support, they only support one or two movies playing at that theater, which defeats the whole point of MoviePass, which was you can go to any theater, any movie. So like you, I actually had trouble canceling my MoviePass initially, as did you, but then last week or the week before, I was able to do it and I canceled it as well.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I feel like they're they're very rapidly going under. So they're resorting to, I think, either their infrastructure is crumbling, because the reason we couldn't cancel was the cancel button wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And you go online and there's no way to cancel it online. So you have to get on to their online chat, and their online chat didn't respond. I had it open for almost 2 hours and no response. So it was very difficult for me to cancel out of it. And I felt that that was kind of the tactics of, you know, kind of like when you want to cancel your recurring mm-hmm. magazine subscription, or,
right.
you know, just throwing hurdles in your way to keep their revenue stream going. And I felt that was a little dirty, but nonetheless, I mean, I think what it has opened the door for is other business models, and I think AMC's is interesting. Yeah, again, I worry about the benefits of this to the movie industry as a whole. I mean, I think more people in more theaters watching more movies is always a good thing. You just kind of worry about the increasing kind of, you know, kids mm-hmm. watching the Marvel movies over and over again, you know, because they get to watch it 3 times a week or whatever. I do feel like there's a mode where they could somehow incentivize you watching maybe some of the riskier picks, so that we're not, you know, constantly bombarded with you know, the hits, the blockbusters, the sequels, you know, all the things that we complain about, and get to see more of the original movies.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, you know, it'll be an interesting couple of years as this kind of thing shakes out. I think, again, subscriptions are good in the sense of if they can get you to see more content, that's good for everyone.
Yeah.
And the good thing about the AMC A-list is that even in their luxury theaters where you have reserved seating and the big, you know, reclinable chairs, it still works even there. And the 3D and the IMAX yeah. and all of it. So that's pretty good.
And most AMCs are pretty nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'll be interested to see how that works. So literally, we just signed up because the first movie that Rashmi and I saw with this was Widows. And it surprised me that a supposedly sold-out screening had empty seats. The two seats immediately to the left of me were empty, and they were in a good row. So I worry that people are reserving because they have this,
showing up,
and they're not showing up, which again, that's kind of too bad. I think that's lost revenue for the theater in some way.
Right.
Anyway, two movies to talk about, but before we do that, let's do a couple of Netflix picks in our usual segment. I can't find anything to watch on Netflix. That's actually a misnomer of a segment. There's so much to watch on Netflix, but we call it that because it can be intimidating at times, and as we often talk to people, the Netflix interface does what it can to surface those movies that you may be interested in, but oftentimes it's hard to find the gems among all of the other stuff that's there. So what are your Netflix picks of this week?
Yes, you go first.
So I'm going to go with an oldie but goodie, which easily is one of the best movies made about human contact with alien life form. And it is Steven Spielberg's 1977 Hallmark movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And if you haven't seen it, you must see it. That one note thing.
Yeah.
And quite simply, it kind of set the groundwork for movies about how humans would come about making contact with an alien life form. And it follows the story of a man who is kind of almost obsessed beyond reason in believing that some life form is trying to get in contact with humans, and he eventually makes his way to find that his instincts had been right, and that the United States had actually set up a whole
camp
to make contact. And it's, for that time, the special effects are incredible. It's emotionally very strong. Terry Garr is in there as a woman who's little boy is abducted by a spaceship very early on in the movie, and that I saw that when I was 8 years old, and it's in my mind.
It can play like a reel too.
In my mind. It was that indelible. So
and
anyway,
scary.
It's scary.
So an 8 year old.
I can talk about this for a while, but I won't. It's my Netflix recommendation, Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
We were lucky enough to see that in the past year on the big screen.
I was just going to say, we just saw it at one of those ArcLight presents.
So our ArcLight theatre, talking about movie theatres, which do, you know, which do kind of great stuff as far as movie lovers are concerned. ArcLight does this series, ArcLight Presents, where they show older movies on the big screen.
And it really held up.
It was interesting, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it felt like it was of its time, but being there in the big screen experience was something that I'd never actually experienced because I was too young to watch that movie in the theatres at the time that it originally played. Maybe not too young, but maybe... I think it was
PG.
It was late 70s, perhaps. And, you know, not necessarily a movie that you would have taken somebody my age at that time to see. So it was a really great experience to see that up on the big screen. And you know, those big moments with the foghorns and the sounds. Mm-hmm. So good.
The abduction is scary. Yeah.
So well.
Great pick, Kirsty. Rashmi, what's your pick?
Okay, my pick is one that we saw and raved about at Toronto Film Festival. It's called 22 July, and it's about the deadly attack in Norway, where a number of people, 77 people, were killed. But this is made by Paul Greengrass, and that's notable because he also did Captain Phillips and United 93, and he's really good at capturing real events in a film form, I think. So it's an R-rated movie. It was straight to Netflix with a very limited release in theaters. It's an amazing movie. It's probably... And we gushed about this in a previous podcast. But yes, I think you put it really well, which was it doesn't come with a lot of fanfare, but what it does so well.
Yeah. It's a lot of people have found it slow and a lot of people find the subject matter very foreboding.
Of course.
Nobody wants to watch a movie about a man who killed 73 people, a terrorist attack. But to the movie's great credit, the terrorist attack ends at the halfway point, and then the second half of the movie is the repercussions from it, which I think are so much more stronger. It's, and he never overplays it. He never sentimentalizes it.
Nope.
It's just a good film.
It's very much two movies in one, and I think it's almost jarring in the way that it begins because Paul Greengrass has this very handheld camera in the moment type direction style. You know, we feel that in the Bourne movies, you jumping through windows and so on, but you know, here he puts us very much in the world of a frightening event, and then the exploration that he does afterwards of the societal impact of such an event and what may have led to it and that kind of thing is very, again, it's almost like watching documentary, you know, it's movie, but again, he has that very real texture to everything that he does. So not a happy movie, not a Friday night unwind from work movie, but not just good, but essential viewing.
Yeah, and important because I think it tells the story of what's happening in many countries all over the world at the moment, which is this nationalistic uprising, and it doesn't sympathize with the terrorist, but certainly it delves into why perhaps this evil man decided to do what he did.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting, we talked in the last couple of podcasts about we had Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and then we have 22nd of July, both of which are kind of quote-unquote straight to Netflix, which has horrible connotations, right? Straight to Netflix.
It used to be straight to video for a bad movie.
But actually, you know, these are incredible movies that go kind of straight to Netflix. And, you know, it's in part because Netflix has so many of the movie-making dollars available to the world right now that they're leveraging that. But the movie I'm going to recommend for my Netflix pick is probably one that maybe is deserving a little more. And I know that sounds very unfair of the old kind of straight-to-Netflix kind of category. And that's Outlaw King, which is not an exceptional movie. It's a very good movie, and it's a very good use of your time. I wouldn't recommend it otherwise. But it's the kind of movie that didn't quite work as well, perhaps, as it intended. In some ways, this movie was a sequel to the 1995 Braveheart with Mel Gibson. It's the story of Robert the Bruce, who was a character that we know very well from Braveheart, but this is more about what happened after the execution of William Wallace, and it stars Chris Pine, so it's definitely a kind of a big star vehicle, directed by David Mackenzie, who we know from the Hell or High Water from the year before.
Exceptional movie.
So, you know, very accomplished direction. The movie, for me, is remarkable in many ways, but the opening scene of the movie is like a 20-minute unbroken shot. I mean, I've still yet to process how that movie was done. So this is a big movie in many, many ways. And of course, you know, we could probably be a remiss to not mention The Full Frontal by Chris Pine, which has been talked about a lot. So I bring it back to the E! News. I know, like, Rashmi and Yesti are grimacing at me. But
no, I'm grinning. I'm actually happily grinning. It was a nice view.
It was so much
fun. It's like all of 2 seconds.
Yeah,
I know, but now you can pause because it's at home. So
yes,
it's not my thing, but yes, if that's for you, then you'll get something out of this.
Everybody pause away.
I bet they have metrics on that at Netflix. I wonder how
oh my God,
the demographics would be. So very brave of Chris Pine to do that. But nonetheless, it doesn't take away. The movie, I thought, was very, very... it's a very interesting story. It's really interesting to kind of see the political fallout, you know, after the events of Braveheart and that time in Scotland when they were fighting the British. So terrific stuff, great battle scenes and good stuff. So
I think it was one of those that was good enough.
No, I mean...
I think it's good.
It is very... I enjoyed it very much at Toronto.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it in the moment, but now I think back, I think it was good enough. It was very big and epic.
It is very big and epic, and like you said, it's not just a run-of-the-mill. I mean, he's doing interesting things. There are these long shots, you know. And I didn't know the story, so it kind of was pretty amazing to me. Okay.
Yeah, again, I think the problem with it was, you know, it had these big scenes that didn't feel like, you know, there's the same moments that we had in Gladiator and Braveheart, yet they were aimed to do the same thing. Anyhow, okay, let's move on then to our... So let's just recap. So we have 22nd of July, Yasti, you have Close Encounters, and I have Outlaw King, so terrific stuff. Lots of really great, fun things to watch on Netflix over the holidays. Or if you're traveling anywhere, don't forget you can also download Netflix movies to your device,
which is
a great way to pass the time if you're on a plane for too much time. Okay, our two movies of the week then are Destroyer and If Beale Street Could Talk. So Yazdi, can you please introduce those movies?
And which one should I introduce first, Joseph?
Why don't we go for Destroyer and then we'll finish with If Beale Street Could Talk.
Okay. So director Karen Kusama first broke onto the movie screen in early 2000s with a movie called Girl Fight with a then unknown Michelle Rodriguez, who we just spoke about in Widows.
Yes.
And she subsequently followed it up with a futuristic, very, very underrated movie with Charlize Theron called Aeon Flux. If people haven't seen it, it's quite amazing.
9% on Rotten Tomatoes.
How many?
Just saying, 9% on Rotten Tomatoes. So
nine,
very...
Yes, 9-0. Yes.
0-0-9.
Oh. Well, I like it. I have a soft spot for Aeon Flux. But anyway, she subsequently followed it up with Jennifer's Body with Megan Fox and Amanda Seyfried and written by Diablo Cody. And she also did a movie called The Invitation, a small movie a few years ago, which is very interesting. It was kind of a small independent movie I think we saw towards the end of the year. Well, now Karen Kusama is here with a new movie, which is getting a lot of hype. It's called Destroyer, and it's getting a lot of hype because it plays the normally elegant and ageless Nicole Kidman in a very inelegant and aged fashion. And essentially, according to IMDb, it's the story of a police detective who reconnects with people from an undercover assignment in her distant past in order to make peace. And even as I said that sentence, I have no idea what that means. it's written by Phil Hay and Matt Manfredi. And then in addition to Nicole Kidman in the title role, we also have Toby Kebbell and Tatiana Maslany, who I really like. She was in Stronger and did a great job. Sebastian Stan is here as well, as is Scoot McNairy, Bradley Whitford. These are all names that, you know, usually speak for good pedigree. Yeah. Yes. So does Destroyer live up to that pedigree?
So I think I'm not the Nicole Kidman fan amongst us, but I think in recent years she's picking really... interesting roles and doing really good work. And I always like a vanity free Nicole Kidman, for which half of the movie she is very vanity free. The only problem is that her vanity free is a little bit zombie looking. So once I got over that, she looked very withdrawn in. I think the makeup was a little bit too much. Once I settled into the movie, I enjoyed this kind of modern day film noir that's set in sort of the underbelly of LA. And, you know, it's a very grungy, dirty movie. And you feel very dirty watching it, not because of the material that's being portrayed, but it's a very grungy portrayal of the place they're in. And she's very dirty in it. And then it's kind of a series of flashbacks. And then by the time it gets to the end, I was pretty wowed. So I enjoyed this movie. I enjoyed the movie. Again, this has happened to me a few times recently where I'm kind of enjoying the movie, but then when it gets to the end, I'm like, ooh, that was actually a very good movie. And I don't want to say too much about it, but yeah, this is a good one.
So, yeah, I mean, I knew nothing about this movie going into it. And, you know, the thing you mentioned, Rashmi, about the way that Nicole Kidman's makeup is done is actually a little off-putting to me, especially at the beginning of the movie where, you know, they really tried to kind of age her and uglify her. And it kind of had that same, I had the same response to it as I did, you know, the guy Pierce in Prometheus, where you kind of look at it and you don't buy what you're looking at because you know that that person doesn't quite look that way.
It's a lot of prosthetic-y.
Yeah, Charlize Theron did it brilliantly in Monster. It didn't bother me at all. But here, for some reason, there was just, you know, there's something I didn't buy about the way that the character looked. And despite Nicole Kidman's attempt to do lots of things as an actor, I felt that distracting. That doesn't mean she didn't succeed. Right, and she did. I think this movie succeeds in spite of that. Noir is not a genre that I like at all. I mean, I have a really hard time with film noir. You know, the kind of the way that the story kind of gradually reveals itself. You know, the movement from one character to another to kind of discover the plot and but like you, Rashmi, I think. As time went on with this movie, it started to pull me into its world, and then I started to believe in its characters, and then I started to care about what was happening to them in the world in which they lived, and then it surprised me. And so I left the movie, and I remember speaking with the you know, the PR rep at the end of it and saying, you know, this stuff, there's so many reasons that this movie shouldn't work for me, being, you know, the kind of person I am, the kind of you know, movies that I like. But boy, does it ever, you know, work well. And I hesitate to oversell this movie because I think it does have some problems. I think there's some really quite clunky dialogue. I think there are also some very obvious
cliches, characters,
and kind of gears that the movie, you know, kind of clicks. You can see what's happening until you don't. So you know, it's it works very well in spite of itself. And I think, you know, that's the thing that is almost the accomplishment here is that, you know, there's many things gone wrong as far as this movie goes, but it works.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's solid.
So it's more than the gimmick of just seeing a very aged, beaten up, uglified Nicole Kidman.
Correct.
For sure.
Correct.
Yeah. And I think...
Because that was my fear, because, you know, that's what the, you know, all the PR for the movie seems to be concentrating on. Look, it's an old Nicole Kidman kind of thing, but...
But, you know, I mean, this is the thing. It's an old Nicole Kidman, but it just looks like she kind of ruffled her hair and, you know, put a face mask on.
I mean, literally, she could be a character from, you know, The Walking Dead at times.
Yeah, and she has this odd cadence about the way that she walks. Yeah, with
stance, the way it led to... But then we find out there's a reason for that. So it reveals very slowly.
It's classic noir. I mean, it's that
Okay.
You know.
Yeah. But it's got some interesting characters, and it's about an underbelly of America that, you know, we don't often see in movies. And again, you know, again, I was irritated by some of the cliche characters and the cliche situations. But
it's a classic despite that, like Joe said. Noir.
Yeah, but despite that, by the end of it, it works.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, so I can sum this one up. You know, this is, it's not an enjoyable time at the movies, but it's an interesting, you know, we don't get a lot of modern noir these days. So just for that reason, it's kind of worth watching. And, you know, just seeing Nicole Kidman do something very, very different is good, I think. And I give her kudos. So solid 7 out of 10 for me.
And you, Joe?
Yeah, I apologize in advance to the people who finance this movie, but this isn't one that you need to rush out and see in the theaters.
Yeah.
You know, on the other hand, they will probably thank me for recommending this extraordinarily highly on the list of movies that if you get the chance to see it at home, on an airplane, any kind of thing, do take the time and give it a moment, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are a couple of things in this movie that just, you know, there's the obligatory kind of rainfall, waiting in a car, in a, you know, kind of cop.
Drunk stalk. Cop. Yeah. Yeah,
you know, there's the, but give it time to kind of work its magic, and you will be rewarded. A 7 out of 10 from me as well.
Yeah.
Okay. There's been some talk about Oscar Best Actress for Nicole Kidman. Would you?
Not on my personal list, and I say that only because it's not. Let's take a look at Melissa McCarthy in that movie we just talked about.
Can you forgive me?
Where it's the actor really doing something special to bring and breathe life into a character. Here it feels like she's acting.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not necessarily the actor's fault. I think that's some of the script problems. I think it's the way that the movie's shot. I feel like it's the makeup, but it definitely feels like acting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I would say that I would be nominating her for Boy Erased instead of Destroyer.
Oh, yeah. Infinitely more nuanced and believable.
Yeah.
Okay. So the next movie that we're going to be talking about is If Beale Street Could Talk. And late 2000s, director Barry Jenkins, then an unknown, made a small independent movie called Medicine for Melancholy, which I remember Roger Ebert at that time very strongly championing that, but it didn't catch much, attention at that time. And then fast forward 8 years later, and he made this other little movie called Moonlight, which did get a lot of attention. Beautiful. Brought him into the spotlight, a story about a boy at three different stages of his life. Very famously, almost did not win the best film prize. Well,
2016.
In 2016, because the presenter, Faye Dunaway, and
Warren Beatty,
Faye Dunaway misread La La Land, but then it was corrected and it did win. Anyway, that's the story. Barry Jenkins' next movie after winning Best Film with Moonlight was highly, highly awaited. And I think he used his recently acquired, cachet in Hollywood to make a movie which is based on an old James Baldwin classic called If Beale Street Could Talk. And that's the same title of the movie, and it's a period piece set, I believe, in the early 60s.
Correct.
And it tells the story of a woman in Harlem who desperately scrambles to prove that her fiancé is innocent of a crime while also carrying their first child together. And it stars Kiki Layne, Stephen James, and Regina King, amongst others. And the writing credits are, of course, James Baldwin for the original book, and then Barry Jenkins, who wrote it for the screen. I've been wanting to see this again. It's been getting a lot of good press coming out of film festivals. But what I've heard somebody write in one of their film reviews, which has stuck with me, is that there are very few movies about which get love right, and this movie really understands love in capital L-O-V-E. Gosh, so I didn't get a chance to see this. The both of you did.
I did not know. But
oh, you did not?
Rashmi.
Oh, Rashmi is the only one who saw it.
Oh, that's right. I am the only one that saw it.
Okay.
I thought you did as well, Joe. Okay, so.
So tell us, is this about love?
I'm going to predict, Yazzie, you're going to be a crying mess.
Okay, good.
And
I like that.
I predict, even though Joe didn't love Moonlight like you and I loved it, this one will get under your skin, Joe. This is such a slow and beautiful unraveling of a fairly simple story that's elevated by exceptional acting and direction and production. This has so much to say about race and attitude and the justice system without being in your face or ramming it down your throat. This is stunning. It's such a slow burn that I think if you're not in the right mood to receive it, you're going to think it's just slow and dull. But it does so much. It takes its time over every single scene, and yet there's so little dialogue in it. But I'm gonna say it now. I am gonna put nominations for best acting for Kiki Layne, Regina King, and Stephen James, who are the two main leads in the support. It's a really different story. It's one that we haven't quite seen before. We've seen elements of this in even like Jungle Fever. We've seen that kind of race thing play out, but not like this. You know, Barry Jenkins has proven that he's not just it wasn't just luck. This is an exceptional director. He's done a really good job with this.
Yeah, it's so interesting that, you know, with the near universal, almost completely universal acclaim he had for Moonlight, that he picked this, even within James Baldwin's, you know, body of work, he picked this really obscure little novella to make his next movie. But I've heard that Regina King is exceptional, and that the movie is visually very, very beautiful to look at.
Yeah, and he does this unusual thing. So if Beale Street could talk, is basically Beale Street is apparently, there's a little card that comes up at the top which says that it's where jazz was invented in New Orleans.
Okay.
And so it's the story of like Louis Armstrong and blah blah and blah blah and blah blah. And then as it kind of is narrated by Kiki Layne, a large part of it's narrated, over narrated. As she's speaking, there's these amazing photographs that come up, these old photographs of different things that she's talking about, which I think under anyone else could be a little precious or a bit gimmicky, but for some reason here it just works. And I think he captures love between a couple, love between a family, and just the hugeness of what love will make you do. It's stunning. It's stunning. And like I said, it's very slow. It's a very slow unraveling of an onion.
Sounds like my kind of film.
I can't wait to watch it.
Yeah,
you'll be a blubbering mess.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I look forward to that.
I mean, it really, it at one point, just got my heart. Yeah, kind of how Moonlight did, but in a different way.
Okay. So you want to wrap it up? I mean, I can't wait to watch this.
Sure.
Because it's so... it's a movie which under any other situation would have been completely, completely under the radar.
Yeah.
But it's getting a distribution and everything.
Yeah.
He's put a lot online for this with no-name actors.
Yeah, and I actually heard a story that he... this is kind of a prequel to Moonlight in some ways. It's got nothing to do with Moonlight.
Okay.
But in his mind, I think he thought this was kind of like a prequel to the Moonlight story in some ways.
Okay.
A solid 8, heavy 8, as Yazdi would say. I mean, I don't know why I'm not giving it a 9, but it feels like an 8.
Okay.
8 out of 10. Really good movie. I think I'm giving it an 8 because I think it won't be universally enjoyed by everyone. Like, if you're not in the mood for something that will make you think and it will provoke you and you're willing to just be in the moment, like, you have to be solidly there. You have to pay attention to everything that's going on. But it's beautiful. It's beautiful to look at. And it's the direction is amazing. It's got these beautiful scenes of like New York and Brooklyn. And it's all very gray. And then there'll be these beautiful pops of color in what the people are wearing or what's in the background. And again, it's got a lot to say about a lot of things that are very relevant today, but it's set in the 60s. Really good movie.
Okay. At the back of my book, I have a page where I put like movies which I think will be on my top 10 list, and now it's at 25, and I'm running out of space. So this is a good year for movies.
I don't know how we're going to choose. I don't know how we're going to choose, Yasti.
Okay, well.
Great ensemble again.
And when you talk about how you're going to choose, obviously you're referring to the San Diego Film Critics Society.
Yes, we have our...
So you guys have your kind of think list of things that you're going to catch up on. And, yep. And then voting will be in a few weeks' time. Yeah. And the Oscars have been moved up as well, right? So
yeah, they're a little bit earlier this year, like end of February, I think.
It'll be interesting, to see how...
Yeah,
It's ridiculous to get into Yeah, but it's ridiculous to think, like, you know, we're talking about these movies now and a quarter later in March is when the awards come. So that's a bit silly.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's another show.
Indeed. All right. Well, let's wrap up the podcast for now. Thank you again for listening. Appreciate the support of all the Movie Wireless listeners. So do drop us a line, facebook.com/MovieWireless. Twitter.com/MovieWallahs, Instagram.com/MovieWallahs, everything.com/MovieWallahs. Check us out, interact with us. We'd love to hear from you. And until our next podcast, it's Too Many Movies, Too Little Time. Hey, goodbye for me.
And me.
And me as well.